All right, joining us now is David Beto. He's an emeritus professor of history at the University of Alabama. Right now, he is a senior fellow at the Independent Institute, an excellent organization. And we're going to talk to him about freedom issues. The book that he has here, published by the Independent Institute, is The New Deal's War on the Bill of Rights, the Untold Story of FDR's Concentration Camps, Censorship, and Mass Surveillance. Thank you for joining us, David, thank you. This is something that I think everybody's going to find very interesting because we know so much about FDR and what he did with the war. People talk about Pearl Harbor. They talk about the economic takeover. But this civil liberties aspect is something that's not usually talked about much.
Yeah, it isn't talked about. And I'm interested in those issues, certainly. Mm-hmm. But I said to myself, why don't I just zero in on this? And the more I found, there was a story here that really has not been told, or it's only been lightly told, about FDR's attitudes toward the Bill of Rights, towards the protections of the First Amendment, toward privacy, and so forth. And FDR's record is atrocious.
Yeah.
I would say worse than Woodrow Wilson, and that's saying a lot.
it really was. And, of course, it was a major change, and so many things were restructured. When we look at him, he really did rule as a tyrant. And we've always had this kind of construct that liberals are for civil liberties and Republicans and conservatives are for economic liberties. You know, they're good on those two things. And actually, they're not. The liberals are not good on civil liberties at all, are they? And FDR is proof of that, isn't he?
He's proof of that, although one of the more encouraging things that I found in this book is there was pushback against FDR coming from a lot of people on the left. Not only conservatives, but people like Norman Thomas, a great defender of civil libertarianism, who was a socialist. There were New Dealers in the Justice Department that really pushed back against a lot of things that he did, including Japanese internment.
Mm-hmm.
So in contrast to Woodrow Wilson, FDR is getting a lot of pushback from people, from subordinates, from New Dealers, from conservatives, some socialists. And that is, for me, an encouraging lesson for today, that maybe there is potential for people on the left and the right to get together to defend civil liberties, because if they don't, then they're more isolated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, let's begin with the concentration camps, because that is the one aspect of the civil liberty stuff that people are somewhat familiar with. But break that down for us, exactly what was done to the Japanese Americans and when this all began as the war was rolling out. When did the concentration camps begin?
Well, the standard view of FDR you're going to get in textbooks as well. Japanese internment is a bad thing, and he shouldn't have done that. But they often portray him as distracted, as it's really, this is done by subordinates. He went along with it. There was hysteria.
I see that with Trump all the time about the lockdowns. Yeah, he was distracted. He was playing 4D chess, or he didn't know what was happening or whatever. But yeah, that's always what the apology
is. Yeah, FDR, the great leader, right? The guy that's always on top of things.
Yeah.
Is somehow clueless and distracted. That was not convincing to me. And the more I looked into it, is that FDR is a leader on this. He's very much proactive. In the 1920s, his attitudes towards the Japanese were very clear. He said, California is right to deny Japanese immigrants the right to own land, for example. We can never have racial mixing with them. It just isn't going to work. In the late 30s, he said that if there is a war with Japan, we need to put any Japanese American who had met with Japanese sailors or their family members, we need to put them, in his words, he uses the term concentration camp. There's a debate, are these concentration camps? Well, I think they are. They're not death camps. I don't think they're the same as the Nazi death camps. Mm-hmm. But FDR called them concentration camps, and I think that's what they are. Mm-hmm. So he was prepared for this. He was already talking about it. But he's very smart. FDR has deniability. He's very charming. He would not talk about this in public, but he lets it happen, right? After Pearl Harbor, it took 2 months for him to issue his executive order. And he sort of subtly opening the door to people from below to say, all right, you want to put them in concentration camps? Well, we'll consider that. And then he signs off on it. But the initial attitude of Americans after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the press is not one of, gee, we should put the Japanese Americans in concentration camp. That takes time to happen. And FDR lets that hysteria develop and signs off on it. Mm-hmm. So he is proactive in this. He's not clueless. He's a very well-informed man. He knows about the issues. He knows what's going on. And there are a lot of top people that are telling him, you don't have to do this, including his own attorney general, Francis Biddle. And Biddle is very much against this. He ends up going along with it, but he tells him, Mr. President, we don't have to do this. There isn't this demand for it. J. Edgar Hoover is against it. Secretary of the Interior. A lot of top people in the Justice Department are telling him, don't do it, and he does it.
Oh. And of course, it served a very useful purpose for him. If he could, always to create the enemy, especially an enemy amongst us, that heightens the fear and people running to the leader for help. And very easy to do that when you got people who don't look like you. You know, they couldn't do that with the Germans so easily and people of German descent. But I imagine they might have squeezed some of that stuff in there in more subtle ways. But that was really kind of a PR thing. What was it? He did it with an executive order. So what is the presumed authority that he might have claimed to be able to do something like that, to arrest people just because they're Japanese?
Yeah, well, you look at his executive order, it's right, and I used to have students read it, but they couldn't figure it out. And I realized when I looked at it, I couldn't figure it out because it uses terms like persons whose removal is who must be removed. It never uses the term, it's like the Constitution, never uses the term, Constitution never mentions the word slavery. FDR's executive order never mentions Japanese Americans. He says, basically, it's a military argument, right? He sort of says, well, the military, this has been deemed necessary for national defense. So we have to remove these people from these areas, namely the whole West Coast. And then what we'll do, then the initial order says we'll remove them. Then it says, well, then they have to go to these assembly centers and so forth. So they're told essentially they can't live where they are. And they have nowhere else to go, and we will create these camps for them. Wow. But he never uses the term Japanese or Japanese Americans. That comes later in the enforcement orders, which are signed by the military. And that's why he's able to shift blame to them. And it's all people of Japanese ancestry.
I didn't do it. That it was those Democrat
orphans.
Governors.
That includes people in orphanages. So they actually say, well, they got to go to the camp. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. But I didn't do it. It was the Democrat governors who did it, or it was the military who did it. And so I guess it was if you were a Japanese American, you're minding your own business, and then you get a knock on the door and it's a bunch of uniformed soldiers. Was it the military that was going out and rounding people up and taking them in?
Yeah, what they do is it's publicized, right? So they'll go to the neighborhood, they'll put posters everywhere and say, report to this assembly center on June 8th, right? You go there and they take you to camps. And you got a family dog you love? Well, too bad. Wow. You can't take that dog with you. You better figure out what to do. Wow. You got some property? Well, you better sell it. And of course, there's a lot of bargain prices. So they're only able to take the bare essentials with them.
Wow.
It's really quite cruel. And the cruelty of this is part of the story. Mm-hmm. FDR keeps them in the camps until late, 1945, basically. Keeps them through the 1944 election. Even though by 43, the U.S. is winning the war. Again, the advice he's getting is even more overwhelming from top people in the government. You can let them go now. But he says, well, there's that California. I want to carry California. Mm. And so he keeps them there.
And so they didn't.
And so there's a cruelty there, mm-hmm. a cold-blooded aspect to him that people haven't picked up on.
So they kept them interred until the papers were signed, essentially with Japan, I guess. And then
it was clear that the Supreme Court was going to rule on. And they did this in, I think it was December 44. So he knew that the court sustained it, but he also knew that it was going to be ruled on. So to deflate that, basically they announced, well, we're going to let him go. We're going to wind down the camps by the end of 1944. That's what they did. So it was a kind of a farcical situation, mm-hmm. but they knew basically at that point the election is over, and they decided at that point to do it.
Wow!
And they knew the courts were going to start ruling on it, and
Oh, that's amazing. And of course, as we were talking off air, you pointed out that there was also actions that he took against a black GOP member. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, that's one of the more interesting chapters of the book for me. Someone told me about this, and I said, "Well, this is interesting, but how does it figure into the broader story?" And they looked into it, and it fits in just perfectly. Mm-hmm. Now, there was this guy named J.B. Martin. He was the head of the National Negro Baseball League. He owned a drugstore. He's African-American in Memphis. And it was kind of a showcase drugstore. A lot of people went to it. He was a pretty wealthy guy. Well, he was a Republican, and he was the head of the Shelby County Republican Party, the Memphis Republican Party. And they had a weird deal with the local mayor there. Well, he wasn't mayor. He was mayor briefly, but he was a city boss, Boss Crump. And Crump had a deal with the black Republicans. He said, "You guys can vote. However, when I need you for particular things, you're going to serve me." And they were in charge of vice and that kind of thing, right? So mm-hmm. he sort of uses them as a tool. Well, by the late 30s, Crump no longer needs them as much because he's become very close to FDR. He's getting a lot of New Deal money. But Martin doesn't know that, maybe he shouldn't push it. So 1940, Martin wants to carry the state for the Republicans, for Wendell Willkie. And he organizes a quite massive interracial rally. So there are white Republicans in Tennessee. They tend to be from the mountain areas, and they have this alliance with these black Republicans. And he has this rally, gets over 1,000 people. Boss Crump is upset, and he says, "You don't do any more of those rallies, or I'm going to police you." And Martin says, "Well, I'm sorry, I'm going to do it." And he did it. And what does that mean, policing? Well, Boss Crump sent in police to search every customer, white or black, coming in or leaving the drugstore.
Wow.
Every customer. And eventually, basically, Crump had a kind of license to bond prisoners and so forth, but it was informal. So it was clear that Crump was going to throw Martin in jail. So Martin leaves. However, he comes back 2 years later to go to a baseball game in a stadium he helped to build. The police come to his box at the stadium and tell him, put him in a holding cell, and then he's told he better get out of the city.
Wow.
All right. Now, okay. So Martin and others go to the federal government and complain. And what happens is that the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, the guy there just says, "This is really a slam dunk case against Crump here. This is like reported in the newspapers and, it's like a big deal, right? That he's doing this." Even the local Memphis paper saying this is going too far. Mm-hmm. And he's ready to prosecute, deposes Martin and so forth. But it goes to higher ups and it's vetoed. And A. Philip Randolph, the labor leader, who's very strong on civil liberties, comes to the aid of Martin and goes to Eleanor Roosevelt. And she sends a very brief note saying, "I've been told we're not supposed to look into this, that this isn't a good idea," and nothing happens. Wow. Nothing happens. And again, Crump is very close to Roosevelt, to both Roosevelts. He had supported Franklin since 1931. He had played a key role in getting him in the nomination. He gets a lot of federal money. He's an important figure in 44 to get Truman in. Mm-hmm. And so forth. So Roosevelt has this alliance with big city bosses like Crump, and they can do whatever they want, suppress the vote, and he's not going to do anything. And that's exactly what happens in this particular case.
Wow. Wow. And of course, you know, they many people try to point out the history of the Democrat Party vis-a-vis the black community. And it was still happening at that point in time. And then very quickly, they just kind of reversed themselves. It's kind of interesting. It's kind of like seeing the guy who started Southern Poverty Law Center, Morris Deese, and how he went from defending the Ku Klux Klan to all, you know, takes a powder, works on building a business that is direct mail, and then comes back in as an anti-Klansman, even though the only thing he did in the civil rights was to defend the Ku Klux Klan. It is interesting to see how the Democrats very rapidly did a complete U-turn on all this stuff and made that their issue, isn't it?
Yeah, and Roosevelt really, you know, I mean, I don't talk about anti-lynching, but there's an anti-lynching bill, and it's filibustered and stopped by the Democrats. Previous presidents, Coolidge and Harding, had supported the bill. Roosevelt does not support the bill, and it is he doesn't do anything for civil rights, basically. But a lot of money is spent, and a lot of relief money, and he's able to use that effectively with not only African Americans but whites, throwing that money around in a big way. It's very important. There's stories that people at the WPA would get the phone and they did forget themselves and they'd say Democratic headquarters, right? So it was intermingled, the relief money and the political machines. And these local political machines, FDR is perfectly willing to use them, but creates his own machine in a sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk a little bit. You know, you mentioned Woodrow Wilson, another a very dangerous precedent. I call him a president, but he's also a precedent. A lot of precedents that he set. When we talk about censorship, that's one of the other aspects of your book here. With Woodrow Wilson, I frequently talk about the Supreme Court case where he threw a guy in jail for a movie that he did. And I talk about it in terms of, you know, hey, the Supreme Court reverses itself frequently. You know, when everybody says this is such and such is the law of the land, they're always reversing themselves and making wrong decisions. Sometimes they do it pretty quickly. Sometimes it takes decades. But they locked this guy away because he did a movie called The Spirit of 76, which had the British as a bad guy. And the Supreme Court upheld that. He got a jail sentence and a pretty stiff fine because Woodrow Wilson wanted to portray the British as our allies. What was the kind of things that FDR was doing in terms of censorship?
Well, FDR, of course, had experience during the Woodrow Wilson administration. He was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And his attitude was, if anything, more anti-civil libertarian than other people in that administration. One guy, for example, did an article. He said, well, why isn't, kind of implied, satirical, why isn't FDR in uniform, Assistant Secretary of the Navy? He's in his 30s. Why isn't this guy in the Navy himself? And FDR was so mad that he went to the federal prosecutor and said, why don't you prosecute this guy? And the prosecutor said, well, we really don't have a case. And FDR said he should be in, you know, in the penitentiary. You know, he should be, you know, that was his attitude. So he comes in with this kind of attitude. And FDR's view is social good, right? We need social justice. The ends are the important thing, and let's not worry about the means. All right. Well, censorship. There was a senator named, this is one of the cases where there was pushback. There was a senator named Sherman Minton. There's a bridge in Indiana named after him. When I look him up, that's the main thing that comes up. But Minton was head of a committee in the Senate that was investigating anti-New Deal organizations, and he was getting a lot of pushback from these people. So Minton got very frustrated and proposed a bill that would have made it a felony to publish any newspaper article known to be untrue. Now, again, the president and the New Dealers are very worried about misinformation. They're very worried about fake news. In fact, I think they even use that expression. Now, the question is who put Minton up to it? And I don't have slam dunk evidence, but people at the time said Minton was not the kind of guy to do this kind of thing on of his own. So I think FDR was floating a trial balloon. That's my opinion. But what happened was there was universal opposition to this bill coming from the left and the right. And Minton had to pull it. Even a guy, you know, these leading New Deal newspaper publishers said, you can't do this. This is going too far. Mm-hmm. And he had to pull it. Now, more direct FDR involvement was with Minton's predecessor, Senator Hugo Black, who was an attack dog for the New Deal in the Senate. Black had a committee, was having a similar problem. He was investigating anti-New Dealers. They were not being very cooperative. They were getting some public sympathy. So Black said, comes up with the idea, or someone does, what if I could get access to their private telegrams? Then I could really ambush them. Now, telegrams are the email of the day, over 50% of long distance communication. They were instantaneous in many cases. Companies would have telegraphers. You would say things in telegrams you wouldn't say in, you know, letters, you know, off the cuff, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. You didn't save them generally. Mm-hmm. And so he went to the telegraph companies, Western Union, says, I want to get all telegrams sent, for example, by every member of the Congress over a 9-month period, wow, to and from going through Washington. I want all those. And, Western Union says, well, we're not going to do this. Customers aren't going to like this. And so he goes to the Roosevelt administration and the FCC, we're working in tandem, and they basically instruct Western Union to do this. And they don't want to do it, but they agree. So Black staffers and Western Union people FCC people go into Western Union one day and said, okay, give us, you know, these telegrams, right? They went down the list, who's in Congress and so forth. And they would bring out these big stacks because the law required Western Union to keep copies of all telegrams, right? Hmm. So they had to keep copies of all of them. So they go through these copies. They go through several thousand today, and it adds up to over 3 million that they go through.
Wow.
And the instruction comes from Black's staffer. Says, well, if you see things of a personal nature, don't worry about that. Don't look at that. Look at anything having to do with lobbying. And what is lobbying? Any attempt to indirectly or directly influence, political policy. So what we're doing would be lobbying, right?
Yeah.
So anything like that. It's about as broad as you can get. And they go through these. And eventually it comes out because Western Union starts to inform people that this is going on. One of the people they inform is Senator Newton Baker, who'd been Secretary of War under Wilson. Baker's kind of a moderate, you know, New Dealer, kind of quasi-New Dealer, you know, kind of just this mild-mannered guy. He is so outraged by this that he finds out his telegrams have been searched that he says, look, if somebody saw somebody lynching Senator Hugo Black, I would not join the lynching, but I would not stop them from putting the noose around his neck. And this is a mild-mannered guy. Anyway, this is a long story, and there's a lot of pushback. There are court suits that are successful against this. But Black is able to get all this booty, and then he gets on the Supreme Court because Roosevelt is very appreciative. This is the main thing that reason that Roosevelt puts Black on the court. He's very appreciative of this. That's the story of that. But it is condemned, though. Again, this is another thing. You get people like Walter Lippmann, someone who's a liberal. You get a lot of Washington Post. You get a lot of people in the press who are normally supportive of Roosevelt saying, this is going too far. And there's pushback against it.
That's interesting. Yeah, human nature doesn't change, does it? Especially the human nature of politicians. It's just that they've got better tools today. All this stuff that you're talking about, well, we're going to look for misinformation. We're going to see if we can find something on anybody. It reminds me very much of what Truman said eventually about J. Edgar Hoover, how he's got files on everybody, and he's trending towards a Gestapo. This is really pretty pervasive. It's just that it wasn't as widely reported as things are right now, and it wasn't directly affecting the public in the same way the social media surveillance and things like that are rolling out. And so it was kind of the people who were inside politics that knew about this, that were getting directly impacted with this. Now with the technology, they can do this with everybody. But the impulse is always the same, isn't it?
I will disagree in one sense. This was headline news, front page news, Black Committee, the Black Inquisition. That's what it was called. Wow. I mean, I'm not just talking about right winger. I mean, this was kind of, and it's interesting how historians had just.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Just do a search at ProQuest. You'll just see Black Committee. My God, all this stuff coming up, and historians have not paid attention to it. But you're right in a sense that a lot of this can be hidden a lot more effectively.
Yes.
Right.
And it's been hidden by the historians. And it's been hidden by the historians. So it's good that you brought that out. As you point out, well documented at the time, but then flushed down the memory hole for the most part as they polished up the image of FDR. Let's talk about something that a lot of people that listen to this program be concerned about, and that, of course, is what FDR did with gold in terms of talking about civil liberties. It was H.L. Mencken who said, a year ago, if I had a flask of whiskey in my pocket and a gold coin, the whiskey was legal. The whiskey was illegal and the gold was legal. Now this year, the whiskey is is illegal and the gold is illegal. Tell us a little bit about that and people's reactions to his gold confiscation.
Well, I didn't focus on that very much, but I certainly agree with you. I could have done a whole chapter on that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, just a fundamental violation of the freedom of contract, of contractual rights. Mm-hmm. And again, there were people in the administration who recognized this and were outraged by it. But FDR is able to take advantage of this window of opportunity, which doesn't last that long when he becomes president, but it lasts for a while where he can just, everybody's willing to say, well, this is the president. This is a crisis worse than as bad as the Great World War. They're often comparing it to the war. This is a wartime situation. It's very much like, what we saw with COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And, the Patriot Act and so forth. This wartime footing. And people are willing to defer to the executive branch. And that's another example of that.
And of course, what we look at is the standard procedure. As I said, human nature doesn't change. The tactics that these people use doesn't change. Their technology is the thing that's changing. But it's always about generating this sense of fear, the sense of fear about the other, as we see with the Japanese concentration camps and that type of thing. And just using this sheer demagoguery and the power politics behind the scene to get whatever they want done and to keep people quiet about it. Talk a little bit about some other instances of mass surveillance and censorship that were going on in the FDR regime.
During World War II, you had a situation. It was very different in World War I. World War I, there remained a lot of opposition to the war. Most of Roosevelt's opponents pre-war, including some of these big publishers and so forth, the Chicago Tribune and the so-called Patterson McCormick interests, they all said after Pearl Harbor, we support the war, right? Mm-hmm. So there really isn't much opposition left. World War I, there's a lot of opposition, a lot of people go to jail and so forth. So FDR really wants to go after these people who had opposed him before the war. However, he's getting some pushback. His own attorney general basically says, well, they're not against the war anymore. They're not obstructing the war. They pledged support for it. But he blames them for holding, for restraining him in the pre-war period. And he very much wants to go after them, but he gets pushback. But they do prosecute. So in other words, the standards are the same as World War One, if not even more severe to be prosecuted. However, there just aren't as many people that are opposed to the war. So they're sort of searching around for people to censor in a way. FDR wants to do a lot more censorship, but he's getting pushback from the Justice Department. And they go after one little paper called the, it's almost got a vendetta against this, called the Boise Valley Herald. And this is a paper that's anti-New Deal, defends Japanese Americans, is pro-civil rights. But they remain critical of the war. They're one of the rare people to be critical of the war. And so they go after this little small-time newspaper. Daily newspaper has weddings and obituaries and off to that. They make a case out of it. They prosecute them under the Espionage Act. Where World War One, they were prosecuting a lot of people, but a lot of people were still against the war.
Mm-hmm.
The situation is a little different than in World War One in that sense. But FDR is not more tolerant. I would say he's less tolerant. Because he really wants to, he wiretaps people, leading publishers. Hmm. He goes after the black press in a major way. That story has not been told because the black press is very critical of the administration. And they are talking about prosecuting them for sedition. But people go to FDR and say, look, you can't prosecute the Chicago Defender and the Pittsburgh Courier for sedition because you want the black vote, and they're a main source of news, right? Mm-hmm. You don't want to alienate them. So what they do is FDR has the FBI go around to these black publishers and basically tell them, okay, cooperate or you might get prosecuted. And basically the black publishers said, well, give us more access to news and we'll cooperate. And they don't get more access. But what happens is, there were all kinds of stories in the black press about federal mistreatment of African Americans, about discrimination in the military, about discrimination by federal contractors, discrimination in government programs. Those stories disappear over time. Hmm. Instead, you're getting stories criticizing private employers, private discrimination, or things like that. Mm-hmm. They actually start pulling their punches because there's this kind of really quite effective indirect censorship. Mm-hmm. Where they get a visit from the FBI and they say, we're very concerned about this.
Wow.
And these black publishers back off. So they're not formally charged with sedition, but they are strong-armed and intimidated to ease up on their criticism of the administration.
Now, you're talking about earlier, you know, that there was a sense of, like a war that had not happened yet, but the sense like we have, like they used with the Patriot Act and 9/11 and that type of thing. And so in the lead up to this, a lot of this stuff is happening before the war. We expect to see some censorship stuff. They're going to make the statement of national security, but this is stuff that was happening, a lot of this before the war. Talk a little bit. You mentioned the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. He was right there with Woodrow Wilson. He kind of cut his teeth on all that stuff with the Palmer Raid and helped to create the FBI. He was keeping files on everybody. What was the relationship between FDR and J. Edgar Hoover? And how did he use the FBI besides what you just talked about, intimidation?
Well, Hoover was a loyal servant of FDR. I don't find him to be as big a player as a lot of people do. Because if you look at Hoover's wiretaps in a single day, for example, he might be wiretapping, 150 people, right? You know, mm-hmm. It's a lot of this is illegal, black bag jobs, off the books. But it isn't this massive scale. Hoover is actually against Japanese internment. So in some cases, he kind of pushes back on FDR in a good way. Now, the main way Hoover had come in...
Well, let me ask you about that. What was his argument against it? Was it... Because I can't imagine J. Edgar Hoover being a civil libertarian. What was his argument? Was it a pragmatic argument against it? What was his argument?
He does make arguments like, well, these are American citizens. We shouldn't do this. He says that. Mm-hmm. However... he doesn't want anything to do with it, right?
Right. It's just going to be something in the state.
He doesn't want his agency to have anything to do with that. So he hands it over to the military, but he is against it. He doesn't think it's necessary. He, in fact, does tell FDR, look, we don't have that severe a problem with the Japanese American population. There isn't an espionage problem here, you know, of any significance. You know, we don't have to be concerned about that. Mm-hmm. Now, the FBI, there is one thing during the war that the FBI does play a role in, is investigating, that I didn't talk about, but it's very timely. And that's the Great Sedition Trial of the war. This is a trial, sounds very familiar here, where they get 30 defendants from all around, 32 defendants from all around the country. They scoop them up. And, you know, you find some guy that has a little newsletter in Topeka, Kansas. Well, let's bring him in. And these are people that had been, you know, a lot of them were kind of anti-Semitic, that had been anti-war, but some of them weren't. And they're all brought to Washington and prosecuted in D.C. under the Smith Act. And there's a provision of the Smith Act, which was originally aimed at communists, but most of these people are right-wingers, who had supported the Smith Act, interestingly enough. And in this, it says, promoting insubordination in the U.S. military with the goal of participating in a worldwide Nazi conspiracy. Hmm. All right. Most of these people didn't even know each other. They didn't like each other. And they're all, a lot of them are kind of crazy. And they're all brought to Washington in one courtroom. They each have their own lawyers, and it's completely chaotic. And over time, a lot of people on the left recognize that, look, the government really has no case against these people. They start, Washington Post compares it to the Moscow purge trials. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these lawyers, court-appointed lawyers and New Deal lawyers, end up becoming sympathetic to the case of these often wacky defendants. And the trial, it becomes very chaotic. And it ends because the judge dies. He has a heart attack. And a lot of people think he lost control of this trial. And this, you know, he dies. Hmm. And then the government for a while thinks about continuing it. But people in the Justice Department, like Biddle, didn't really want to do this anyway. It's a sop to FDR. Hmm. He wants to prosecute the head of the Chicago Tribune. So he says, I'll give you these sedition trials. And people on the left are thinking, these are a warning. This is just the beginning. We're going to get these small fry, but we're going to get the publisher of the Chicago Tribune and the Washington Times Herald. We're going to bring these people in eventually. Mm-hmm. That never happens. But I think that there's a hope, even by FDR, that these are just going to be the beginning, but it ends up backfiring for the government. And they have ultimately have to dismiss the charges. But only a few months after this is over with, they start prosecuting communists under the Smith Act. And of course, a lot of these guys that were prosecuted are all for that. Wow. So there's hypocrisy on both sides.
So, J. Edgar Hoover was always a very astute politician. He didn't want the optics of this, the Japanese internment camps, but he he would go for these other trials of you know, political viewpoints. It is kind of interesting to see how that evolved. And talk a little bit about the switch out of the vice president from Henry Wallace. I've always found that to be fascinating to Truman. You know, what was going on behind the scenes there between Wallace and FDR, and what were the power politics behind all that?
Okay. Well, Wallace is made vice president in 1940. The predecessor to Wallace was John Nance Gardner, who was kind of a conservative Democrat, who interestingly enough thought that it was time to have an anti-lynching bill. And FDR, when he found out about this, laughed. He just uncontrollable laughter. And of course, FDR did nothing to bring about an anti-lynching bill. They thought, even Gardner supports this. anyway, Gardner is the vice president, and Wallace, he doesn't get along with FDR, and they bring Wallace in, who's a big pro New Dealer guy, yeah. Right?
Real ideologue.
And kind of a younger guy. He's kind of a dynamic speaker. He's a little wacky, but he's got a base of the pro-New Deal elements in the party.
Seemed to me like
and
a real...
And initially, Wallace is going to run wartime mobilization, but he's so inefficient in the people around him that it doesn't work out very well. Mm. And there's a lot of people in the business community that are very upset by Wallace. FDR likes Wallace. I think he'd rather keep him in there. But in 44, basically, the people in the business community and a lot of these big city machines are telling FDR, look, he's going to be a drag on the ticket. And FDR's, you know, near death in 1944. That's covered up in a massive way. He's in terrible shape. And so they don't want Henry Wallace to be president. FDR may not have figured it out, but, you know, he's probably not going to live much longer. And so they engineer basically kind of a coup at the convention. And Wallace is sort of out of the country during the pre-convention period, so he doesn't prepare very well. But it's kind of a near thing. But they're able to get in Truman, who's considered much more of a kind of moderate Democrat, pragmatic guy, not a woolly-headed idealist. They basically they're able to engineer this, and Truman gets the vice presidential nomination.
That may be.
And FDR, I think, was willing, wanted Wallace, but he wasn't willing to stick his neck out for him because he was pragmatic. He wanted to win. And he thought these party bosses want Wallace out. Well, you know, I'll kind of pull back and let them take him out.
Maybe a foreshadowing of what's to come in this election cycle, right? Kind of a woolly-headed ideologue that can't really do anything if you give him a
problem. Although I've read some of Wallace, and, you know, he's not as – he's more pragmatic guy than, you know, I thought he would be. You know, really? He's sort of like he's into small business and all that stuff. But, yeah, he's still – you know, you could see why they got rid of him.
Yeah,
but he's allied with the new pro New Deal element in the party, and he's seen as a loose cannon.
Yeah, well, it's very important, and it's important for us to see again. As I forget who said it, but you know, history doesn't repeat; it rhymes, and we see so many different rhyming aspects in what you've been talking about here. Again, human nature doesn't change. Political nature doesn't change. The nature of men in power doesn't change. The only thing that changes is their reach. And so we can see how all this stuff plays out. And it really is amazing to take a look at the Bill of Rights aspect of the New Deal and FDR. And but it's always the Bill of Rights has always been, and it was designed that way, as an obstacle to these tyrants. And so it's not really a surprise, is it, that he would take it on directly.
Yeah, that's not a surprise.
That's right.
He's not somebody that cares about due process and you know, individual rights. I mean, those are, oh, maybe he cares in some sense, but if they get in the way of some goal that he has, he's not worried about these little procedural issues. He wants to get the goal achieved.
That's right. Yeah, in the same way that we can see that in Pearl Harbor. You know, hey, if these ships and sailors get in the way of my goal, so what? You know, they're expendable and all this stuff. And so the Bill of Rights was expendable as well. Well, that's a very interesting perspective on FDR, and a very interesting perspective and real warning for what may happen to us in the near future as we see our society as going through this massive change. And with the this part of the fourth turning, it is really a book that should be on everybody's must-read list, I think. So thank you so much for joining us, David. Again, this is published by the Independent Institute, and I think is it available on Amazon, or do they need to go to the Independent Institute?
No, it's available on Amazon, but you can get it directly from the Independent Institute as well.
And that'd be better because you can help to support them instead of supporting Jeff Bezos. It's a great organization, the Independent Institute. And again, our guest is David Beto, who is working with them as a fellow and a professor emeritus of history as well. Certainly do know your history. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you for inviting me.
The David Knight Show is a critical thinking super spreader. If you've been exposed to logic by listening to the David Knight Show, please do your part and try not to spread it. Financial support or simply telling others about the show causes this dangerous information to spread farther. People have to trust me. I mean, trust the science. Wear your mask, take your vaccine. Don't ask questions.
Using free speech to free minds. It's the David Knight Show.